From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center.
You can look at the fragments, for example, in which Heraclitus talks about fire, and it is clear that he has something very important to say about fire, and that according to him, fire is an extremely important ingredient of the cosmos. But it is quite clear to me that whatever it is he's not saying that all things are made of fire.
But the model is essentially a model in which you take the behavior of other people as a given, as something you have to predict so that you adjust your own strategic behavior to those expectations about how other people are going to behave.
Welcome to Soundings, Philosophy Ancient and Modern. Those are the topics this week on Soundings. My guests are two scholars who recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center, Montgomery Firth of the University of California at Los Angeles, and Edward McLennan of Washington University. First on this edition of Soundings, a conversation with Montgomery Firth, followed by a discussion with Edward McLennan about his forthcoming book on rational self-interest. Monty Firth, it's a commonplace to talk about ancient philosophy. You mentioned the names Plato, Socrates, people like that. They're important. They're the biggies. But you're moving back from that a couple of hundred years. You're talking about the pre-Socratics and why they're important. Tell me who they are. Why are they important?
Well, the pre-Socratic philosophers were active before and overlapping with the time of Socrates from about 590 to about 430 BC. Mm-hmm. And they constitute almost an explosion of intellectual activity that we can recognize as the origins of Western science and philosophy. We call it pre-Socratic, although the latter part overlapped with Socrates. It's important both in its own right and for the understanding of Plato and Aristotle and their successors. It's important in its own right because the thought of these people is of extraordinary interest. They were beginning to think for the first time in a systematic way about the most fundamental things, the nature of the universe, its origin, if it had an origin. They didn't agree about whether it did or not. The place in the universe of life in general and of human beings in particular, what is possible for human beings to know about any of these things, and so on. So all the most fundamental questions were wide open. One of the things that everyone thinks he or she knows about pre-Socratic philosophy is that Heraclitus said you can't step in the same river twice.
Mm-hmm. All right.
This attribution comes first from Plato, who says, rather airily, that Heraclitus says this somewhere. Uh-huh. The fragment of Heraclitus that is written in Heraclitus's own Ionic dialect doesn't say that. What it says is that upon the person who does step in the same river twice, different waters flow, which is a very different and much less paradoxical proposition.
Sure.
Plato had his reasons for wanting to discuss a maximum flux metaphysics, and he had no interest whatever in the accuracy of his attributions, and so it was perfectly in Platonic character for him to father the maximum flux metaphysics on Heraclitus, but it wasn't Heraclitus's theory.
So what you're outlining here, Monty Firth, is a kind of politics of philosophy, internecine sorts of dialogues that occurred that, what, in the mind of the general public, often get lost. Am I on the right track there?
Plato is very much the original creative philosopher and very little the meticulous historian of ideas.
I see.
So from the fact that Plato says something about a pre-Socratic, it would be very rash to infer anything historical about the pre-Socratic himself.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, that's one example where the fragments say one thing and the tradition says another. Not everybody agrees with me. I mean, there are people who think that Heraclitus did believe this about the river, but it isn't what the fragment says, mm-hmm. though it is what the whole chorus of ancient testimony says.
Mm-hmm.
A different example, and this is much less widely shared than my view about the river fragment. I think probably it's about 50-50 among interpreters about whether Heraclitus said what people think he said about the river. But on what I'm going to mention now, there is I'm in a much smaller minority. Aristotle says that the very earliest thinkers were interested in the material substratum of all things, or that out of which all things were made. And he has a very elaborate rationale for why it was natural for the earliest thinkers to be after this, be interested in the, what in Aristotle's terms, the material cause of all things. I have become convinced, and more convinced than ever from my research at the center this year, that this account of Aristotle's, which we were all taught in school, there's no, everybody thought, learned that that Thales thought that everything was made of water, and Heraclitus thought that everything was made of fire, and so on.
Mm-hmm. That's wrong. Huh?
I've come to the conclusion that this account is basically wrong for most of the pre-Socratic thinkers down to the time of Empedocles and the Atomists, who are very, very late.
Mm-hmm.
The very earliest thinkers, because of the scarcity of fragments, this is a complicated thing to discuss, and I won't try to discuss it here, but for later in the sequence, when the fragments are fairly copious, you can look at the fragments, for example, in which Heraclitus talks about fire, and it is clear that he has something very important to say about fire, and that according to him, fire is an extremely important ingredient of the cosmos. But it is quite clear to me that whatever it is he's saying, he's not saying that all things are made of fire.
Hmm.
He's ascribing to fire a relationship to all things, but it's not that of being the basic stuff of which all things are composed.
That's an important distinction.
I can give you one example of a fire fragment. One of the fragments of Heraclitus says that fire is to all things as an equal exchange. Fire is an equal exchange for all things as gold is for goods.
Analogous thinking again.
And it's a metaphor. Uh-huh. And it's, in this case, it's a proportion that in that as you can exchange gold for goods in an equal exchange, a fair exchange, the word means an equal exchange. So in some similar fashion, we are told, fire stands to all the things in the cosmos.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we follow this metaphor out, if a bit of gold, say a grain of gold, is an equal exchange for goods, like, say, a pair of shoes, our concept of that is that if it's a fair exchange, value in some sense is conserved when one is exchanged for the other. And I gather we are being told that fire, when something comes to be, some natural thing comes to be, an exchange has taken place for fire, and presumably, something has been conserved. There is conservation of something in an exchange of all things, of a thing that comes to be for the fire.
Well, we come back to this notion of the nature of the physical universe, the indestructibility of matter, and antecedent to that, the question of who or what created it and how it evolved.
Well, let's pursue this. You see, the indestructibility of matter, again, is an Aristotelian idea.
Uh-huh.
When Heraclitus talks about all things of and fire, the fire kindles and goes out, according to Heraclitus.
Uh-huh.
So the fire isn't indestructible. Furthermore,
but the exchange,
whatever the exchange, whatever the is meant by the exchange, anyone reflecting on the universal human convention of exchanging things for gold, no one in his right mind supposes that that works as it does because the things are really made out of gold.
Right.
So whatever the metaphor is, it is not the metaphor of being made out of. Now, it's hard for us to get hold of the notion that Heraclitus has some completely different concept in mind about the fundamental, I can't call it stuff because that's not what it is,
right.
this fundamental entity of the universe, which is fire. But whatever it is, it's not Aristotle's material cause. Now, I said a moment ago, well, something has been conserved in this exchange, in the way that value is conserved in the commercial exchange. What is it, then?
Uh-huh.
I haven't the faintest idea.
And that's what philosophers
this
do for a living.
It's a new theoretical concept. It's not the concept of matter. It's something quite different from matter. Nobody ever worked with it again. It was not, unlike the Aristotelian concept of the matter of something, which has been an extremely rich and fruitful concept, it underlay Aristotle's own theory of matter, it underlies the atomic theory of matter, we're familiar with it now, we no longer think that atoms are destructible, although we retain that name for them, atoms being things which etymologically can't be split. But we still have, at the base of our thinking, this Aristotelian idea. Heraclitus's idea is a distinct theoretical concept that is unlike anything in Aristotle or anywhere else. That's the most important fact, I think, about these pre-Socratics is that they were wildly experimental.
And holistic. It sounds as though, you know, the notion of what two cultures, the humanities, the sciences, for them was what, an unnecessary division. Am I on the right track with that?
Yes. There is no division between what we think of as science and humanities. Mankind inhabits a cosmos of which mankind is a part, but an integral part. And all of them suppose that there is a single account that is accessible to human understanding and that explains what goes on in the universe, everywhere in the universe.
That's a brave assumption for a philosopher to make, isn't it?
It isn't explicit everywhere. It becomes explicit in Heraclitus, and it's explicit after that. But Heraclitus makes explicit the principle that nowadays, in present-day cosmology, is called the cosmological principle. Mm-hmm. The cosmological principle says the same laws of physics hold everywhere in the universe. Mm-hmm. And Heraclitus makes that explicit. Aristotle's physics does not obey that principle. Aristotelian laws of motion, there are one set of laws of motion for terrestrial motion and a different set of laws of motions for celestial motions. Mm-hmm. You have to have two different physics for two different kinds of motions. Since Newtonian times, the cosmological principle has applied in all physical theories. It's explicit in Heraclitus, too. Mm-hmm. And in the other pre-Socratics, though until Heraclitus, it isn't explicit. These thinkers are important both as profound influences on the people that followed them. As I said, Plato and Aristotle did not begin thinking in a vacuum at all, but were reacting positively and negatively, very powerfully, against the views of their predecessors. But also, they're worth study in their own right, because, well, people can differ about this. To my mind, as I said earlier, the basic interest, and this is one of the sources of my interest in the history of philosophy in general, is that it tells us something about the nature of the human mind. That is, when people begin to think about these very fundamental questions, when everything is wide open and up for grabs, what do they come up with? And the variety and imaginativeness of what these pre-Socratics come up with is to me truly amazing. And much of it, and this is where original scholarship is still possible in this field, much of it along directions that were not followed up subsequently, that don't resemble anything in Plato or Aristotle or the Stoics or later people, even people who were influenced by them. I've talked a little bit about Heraclitus as an example of this, as somebody who's wildly original in directions that were simply not followed up later. Another case, which I won't be able to follow up here because it simply takes too long to explain, is Anaxagoras, who, contrary to what everyone since Aristotle has thought, was not trying to evolve a theory about the basic material of which everything is made. His ideas are along entirely different lines, much more original and much more interesting than the version that's been current ever since Aristotle would lead us to suppose. But you'll have to have me back on the radio another time to find out more about that.
We'll save that for another day.
Montgomery Firth is a professor at the University of California at Los Angeles. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Montgomery Firth worked on a forthcoming book about the pre-Socratic philosophers of ancient Greece. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Ancient and Modern Philosophy continues now with a conversation featuring Edward McLennan of Washington University. During his recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Edward McLennan worked on a forthcoming study of rational self-interest, or the concept of human reason in the service of the emotions. Here is Edward McLennan.
Imagine, if you will, a room in which a group of people are brought in, and there's a great big round table in the room. This is where they're going to have their meal.
Okay.
All right? Each person is brought into the room, and they are seated at the table, around this round table. But there are certain constraints. First of all, each person's left hand is tied behind them. and in their right hand is tied a very long spoon. Unfortunately, too long for anybody to be able to turn and reach into their own mouth. That is, they can pick up food from the table, but they can't get it into their own mouth.
Okay.
Right? Now, imagine that everybody is interested, each person, let's say, is interested only in feeding themselves.
Uh-huh.
And they all sit at the table, and they all gnash their teeth and moan and groan because nobody can eat.
Federico Fellini meets the philosophers.
All right. Now, of course, there's a solution to that problem, right. That is. Everybody simply feeds the person to their right or to their left, and
sure.
There's a coordination problem that has to be worked out.
Okay.
If everybody's to get fed, you've got to make sure that you're all in agreement about what the coordination scheme is going to be.
Uh-huh. So this is a sort of paradigm, forcing people to step back and say, how can I meet my own ends and yet at the same time maintain this social sort of interaction that you described?
That's right.
All right.
But now let me elaborate on the story once more. This is not the part that my mother told me is a morality story.
All right.
Imagine the same room, the same round table, and once again a group of people that are brought in, and once again each person's left hand is tied behind them. In each person's right hand...
I happen to be left-handed, incidentally.
Right. I'm sorry about that.
this prejudice that you were displaying bothers me.
All right. In each person's right hand, there is tied a very short spoon.
Okay.
Indeed, it is so short, and the table, the places around the table are spaced in such a way that nobody could feed other than themselves. Now imagine that everybody who was led into the room aspires to be a selfless saint whose only concern is to feed others and never to do anything for themselves.
Uh-huh.
Once again, exactly the same problem occurs. Everybody there wants to feed somebody else and is frustrated by the fact that they can't achieve their objective.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, if they coordinate and if each person feeds themselves, then the goal that each person has of everybody being fed will be accomplished.
All right. I think I get a better sense here, Ned McLennan, of what you mean by rational self-interest. But isn't your example, doesn't this call to mind what? A set of extremes? People live in the real world. Somebody said that all men and women should be philosophers. I take it that, in a way, that's what you're saying, that we need to learn to be deliberative in everything that we do. But again, are you not talking in terms of extremes rather than the sort of mundane middle ground that we all live in?
No, I think the stories I told you a moment ago seem to me to be mm-hmm. archetypal of the kinds of situations that all human beings face all of the time, both at the very, very simple level of interaction between individuals,
uh-huh.
but also, for example, in the manner in which, let's say, nation states interact with each other. I would want to argue with you that something like the problem that I described a few minutes ago and about mm-hmm. the table in the room, it's the kind of problem that nations face when they interact with each other. And the armaments race is a good example of a frustrating situation in which each, in this case not individual, but each individual nation
mm-hmm.
pursues what it thinks is the best set of policies for itself,
mm-hmm.
strategically interacting with others. And the result is that we live in a world in which we are constantly under the threat of mm-hmm. nuclear disaster. The kinds of models of interaction that I study in my own philosophical work, it seems to me, lead one to the conclusion that the way in which nation states interact with each other
mm-hmm.
is highly advantageous to themselves and to other nations.
Are we talking about the ground rules as they exist now, or attitudes?
The ground rules that exist now are the rules of what is called, in the more formal treatment of this subject, namely game theory.
Mm-hmm.
The ground rules are essentially those that are devised by what is called strategic interaction between the various decision-making units. Each unit tries to figure out how best to serve their own interests, predicting the behavior of each other unit in the interacting situation.
To the detriment of trying to figure out what the other guy's self-interest is going to be, and therefore what, somehow advancing the discussion?
No. You do, under that model or scheme of interacting, it's terribly important that you have a good sense of what the interests of the other parties are, because that's the only way that you're
mm-hmm.
able to predict what they're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
But the model is essentially a model in which you take the behavior of other people as a given, as something you have to predict so that you adjust your own strategic behavior to those expectations about mm-hmm. how other people are going to behave.
Your word expectation reminds me of a wonderful line from Herman Melville toward the end of Moby Dick. He paraphrasing it, I'll try. He says something like, what we need to do in this world is lower our conscious notions of our expectations of what's possible and how we're going to be happy individually and in our interactions with other people. Is that what we're after here in this notion of self-interest?
I'm not sure what you mean by lower the expectations.
Maybe compromise is a good word to use. In other words, just figuring out how we're not going to get the whole pie. It's obvious that other elements, other people are going to participate in this and come away with things that maybe we wished we had.
Well, let me go back and try a different tack on this particular question and see if it's helpful. Let me give you another, this time not a morality story, but let's take something fairly familiar, I think, to most people as an example of what I mean by the problem of strategic interaction between people. Consider something like about whether you're going to cheat or not on your income tax.
Uh-huh.
All right? Now, that's something that everybody has to think a little bit about.
Certainly is.
Now, given any level of enforcement, that is, given any system of agents out there who are going to examine us and challenge us and so on, given any level of enforcement, one learns fairly quickly that there are certain things you can get away with and there are certain things you can't get away with,
okay,
right?
Right.
Now, suppose everybody simply tries to, as it were, maximize for themselves, figuring out which things they can fudge on and underreport and where they won't be likely to be caught.
Right? Mm-hmm.
Now, if everybody does that and does it very successfully, what you have is a situation in which the revenues that the government needs are going to decline. And the result is the government will have to tighten the regulations, tighten the surveillance, increase the amount of penalties and so on that are meted out to those who are discovered to have underreported,
uh-huh,
etc. The result will be, under those circumstances, that we will all have to suffer through a good deal more regulation of our financial affairs. And that is a result that flows from the fact that we have all behaved in a strategically effective way. Namely, we've each of us tried to maximize, uh-huh, as best we could given the situation that we faced.
Strategy here being what, a sort of morally neutral term?
In this sense, yes,
yeah,
it's morally,
okay,
neutral.
All right, so how do you bring this concept of rational self-interest to bear on a situation like that? We step aside, and maybe not by direct conversation or discourse, but we all extrapolate. Me and the government, we say to each other, okay, we're going to behave in a different fashion.
That's right. Now, let's go back to your notion about, and your quotation from Melville about lowering expectation.
Mm-hmm.
What I would have said in place of that is that we have to learn to discipline ourselves to accept certain constraints on our behavior.
Uh-huh.
In various kinds of situations in which we have to interact. So it's not that we have to lower our expectations, it's rather that we have to accept a certain kind of discipline of coordination,
mm-hmm,
in our interactions with each other.
Ned McLennan, let's pursue this question of examples of what you're talking about with respect to self-interest. Tell me, for example, how this question might bear. You mentioned the example of the table. We've talked about income taxes. We've talked about disarmament. Let's pursue this question of public policy a little bit farther.
Well, an example in the area of public policy, I think, of what could be called a problem of coordination between people,
mm-hmm,
would be something like the following. Imagine you have a legislature who is enacting various laws, particularly laws of what we would call today pork barrel,
mm-hmm,
legislation.
Right.
Each district has an interest in getting certain projects done in its district,
mm-hmm,
and the proverbial wisdom and the usual model of how you deal with this is that you go into Congress as a congressman and you bargain with other congressmen and you,
right,
support their bill if they'll support your bill. Now, it's been well known for a long time, people who have studied this kind of thing, that the net result of that kind of pork barreling is that there's an overinvestment in certain kinds of public project, that everyone would be better off if the level of such investment were lowered.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, each individual congressman has no interest in lowering the level of commitment on his own part to what he wants done in his district. Let the other person, as it were, cut back their demands, but he doesn't want to cut back his. So everybody continues to make the demands that they, mm-hmm, want projects for their district, and the only way that they get their projects worked, funded, is for them to, in effect, pork barrel and get other people to support their projects.
Okay, so what are you going to bring to bear on this? How are we going to, are you going to tell me you have an answer to this problem?
Well, an interesting way to think about certain moral principles mm-hmm. is to see them as providing certain kinds of guidelines or principles of constraint for how people should interact with each other in that kind of setting.
And what might they be?
Well, in this case, if we all would manage to show some constraint in the amount of pork barreling that we engage in, we'd all be better off.
Uh-huh.
And I want to take that to be a model of the way in which rational self-interest relates to morality.
Uh-huh.
Moral principles have a basis in rational self-interest. They describe ways in which we can coordinate our behavior with one another in such a way that we will all benefit.
Well, moral principles also have a basis in human nature, which, what, the religion people, the philosophers, over the years have told us really doesn't change that much. Are you making some high assumptions here that we need to examine, be suspicious of?
No, I think that if you mean by they have their basis in human nature, what we know is that a great many of the kinds of moral principles that people have evolved are very much keyed to the fact that we are, as individuals, vulnerable beings, beings who are not capable on our own uh-huh. of achieving many of the projects that we would like to. We can only do things if we can get cooperation from other people. We are weak mm-hmm. When we are taken individually, strong if we can behave collectively in certain circumstances.
There's a certain nobility to what you're telling me here. There's a certain, if not nobility, there's a certain virtue, public virtue. I don't want to take you too far afield, but this sounds, Ned McLennan, like the language of the founders of the American Constitution, a kind of collaborativeness.
Yes, I like to think of it that way myself, but note, in all fairness to the position that I've articulated here, mm-hmm. that this is if it is a noble vision of what human beings are capable of, the argument for human beings interacting in that way goes back to a very prosaic point, that each individual could hope to do better with respect to whatever it is that they want to achieve
uh-huh.
if they can learn to coordinate with other people in these ways.
Edward McLennan teaches at Washington University. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Edward McLennan worked on a forthcoming book about rational self-interest. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Ancient and Modern Philosophy, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings would like to hear from you. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, the topics will be agriculture and anthropology in European history between the 16th and 18th centuries. My guests will be Joan Thirsk of Oxford University and Hugh West of the University of Richmond. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
From pre-Socratic philosophy to modern notions of rationality and self-interest. The topics this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center. Listen for some answers and insights from Montgomery Firth of the University of California at Los Angeles and Edward McLennan of Washington University. Philosophy, Ancient and Modern. This week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.